Hello.
Hello. We're live.
Yay. Are we? Are we really?
I mean,
when you really think about it, who can really be alive?
I don't know, animals, mammals, plants.
What if I plucked out their hearts and then would they still be alive?
It depends if they were in a cage being lowered into the glowy, watery pit of Kali Ma.
Yeah. Yeah. So, this movie,
Remember that really good movie we talked about last week?
Raiders?
Yeah.
Raiders of the Lost Ark?
There's no way they could take such a wonderful property and then produce something bad. Building on top of that, right?
Absolutely none. As we've seen, the time only marches forwards for all intellectual property. Things just improve over time.
Mm-hmm.
This is a real stinker. It's one of those things where I often forget what actually happens in this film because I like it so little. Out of all of the Indiana Jones movies, I think it's probably a tie between this and Crystal Skull for which I probably could fail a test on, just by virtue of the fact that I don't think I could recite everything that has happened in it.
Oh, but, sure you could. Nothing really happens in this, and the only things you actually really remember are the set pieces, so could pass on that.
Things happen when you're running from one thing to another thing, and things also happen when you're you got a gross thing, and you got to scream about it. And did you know the screaming counts as an activity? There's a lot of screaming in this. Are you familiar with screaming, Dan?
I'm familiar with screaming. I mean, most of it's from Kate Capshaw, your favorite, but...
No. I feel bad. I'm sure Kate Capshaw is a charming person in real life, because after they made this, Steven Spielberg and Kate Capshaw, got to be all married and stuff.
They weren't married before?
No. No, this was not casting his wife. This was casting somebody, and then they got to be buds. To quote from the Wikipedia page, which is probably great to do for this, Kate Capshaw called her character not much more than a dumb screaming blonde. Steven Spielberg said in 1989, "I wasn't happy with Temple of Doom at all. It was too dark and too subterranean and much too horrific. I thought it out-poltered Poltergeist. There's not an ounce of my own personal feeling in Temple of Doom." He later added during the making of Indiana Jones and the Temple of Doom documentary, "Temple of Doom is my least favorite of the trilogy. I look back and I say, well, the greatest thing that I got out of that was that I met Kate Capshaw. We married years later, and to me, that was the reason I was fated to make Temple of Doom."
Well, there's a lot to unpack in that. I feel like this one was on TV the most of any of the ones that I ever saw. And I feel like this movie is the one that creates a lot of the iconic Indiana Jones imagery. Just sort of, I don't know. The cinematography is great. And I think some of the images you have in your head when you just talk about Indiana Jones come from this movie. But it's not a good story. It's interesting that Spielberg said that there's none of his personal emotion in it, because yeah, there's really no character depth in any of these people in this movie, because you have no idea really what anybody wants on a personal level, or why they care about certain things, or why they're doing things other than just like run away from the big guys and the other guys with the swords and then don't get flooded or set on fire and stuff. So That's difficult to build a movie around.
Yeah, and make Short Round, which is not a good name, make him greedy, and then also make Kate Capshaw greedy, and then you have Indiana Jones, who somehow gets to play as altruistic against that, even though his job is to steal things.
Yeah, I mean they're all sort of trying to play that like serious / silly explorer role, where they all have a little bit of that James Bond playboy attitude, which is weird because it should just be Indiana Jones, but it's not. It kind of just bounces around. They all kind of together build one personality in this movie.
Yeah. And You know, looking through some pieces of information, if this wasn't Steven Spielberg's passion project and Lawrence Kasdan didn't want to write this, that kind of leaves somebody else who was involved with the inception of Indiana Jones on as a major influence, and that would be George Lucas.
Yeah, he's got the story credit.
Yeah, and as you might know, sometimes George Lucas can't really put together a good story, so to speak.
I mean, movie has an okay. This movie has a decent outline, but it's not a story. Every bit of it, even less so. Like, you know, people talk about how in Raiders, Indiana Jones is kind of like just along for the ride or unimportant or whatever. But really, in this movie, he's just sort of going places that people tell him to go, or like he's literally just like he ends up in India because he falls asleep on a plane and then the pilots jump out. Like he had no role in making any of the decisions that brought him to where he was. Like his biggest decision was steal the stones from the thing, and B, get angry and stupid enough to throw a rock at a guy who's whipping a boy. Like those are his two biggest decisions in this movie, and the rest is just sort of like, I don't know, running around.
Yeah, well, then he pushed on the statue torso area, mm-hmm. and they got the secret passage.
Which also doesn't make sense, because...
That's a decision.
Right, but like... the whole palace thing is just so weird. Like, why would they put them in the rooms that lead to the place that they're potentially searching for after they've had that awkward dinner conversation where he insults the what's-his-name dude with the glasses? Like, why would you put that in the room and then also try to kill them? Wouldn't you just want them to, like, leave and just, like, be unsuspecting or something? Because it's not like they were there looking for something in particular. They were just kind of, like, passing through on their way to Delhi and, like, needed a place to sleep. So, I don't know. Like, there's a lot of stuff that makes a little bit of, just like a little bit of sense in like Raiders, but in this one you can't even give it the benefit of the doubt, because like there's no driving force behind anything other than just like, well, I think I'm supposed to go to this place,
and then things happen.
Yeah, and then stuff happens.
Yeah, like when they get trapped inside of the dramatic trap thing.
There's a lot of dramatic set piece things, but yeah, the spiky thing with the things on the other side, the bugs.
Yeah, that whole thing is a lot of screaming and a lot of gross bugs and a lot of tension about spikes.
And a lot of broken continuity. There are even shots that you can see that the spikes are not moving.
Yeah, so. It's kind of weird if you start to think about it, because it's like, oh yeah, you got to reach your hand in that hole to pull the lever thing that we can't get on this side, and that'll release the trap. But it's like, is this just like a standard issue thing? Do you order this from Sears? Like where how would he know that?
Yeah, I mean, I guess it's no surprise that this kind of stuff is turned into like Universal Studios type rides, cuz like that's really what it is. It's not
It really does feel like that Universal Studios ride. Well, no, actually it's not Universal Studios. It's
it's Disneyland, right?
Disneyland. Yeah. It's weird too. Have you been on that?
I have, it's like a big car or whatever, and then there's a lot of like fake blow darts or whatever, which I guess is technically from Raiders, but yeah, it's a lot of that.
Yeah, and it's like, oh, the angry snake god or whatever. Anyway, it's weird. The only reason why he falls into the trap is so they can be in a trap, and the only reason why he knows how to get out of the trap is so they don't die in the trap, so they can keep going with the story. And then the only reason why they get scared out of that room is for comedy, I guess, and then it closes, and no one's really that concerned with the fact that the trap door closed behind them that would lead them back to safety in their rooms. They're cool with that.
There's always another exit. Like, I don't think that's the front entrance to the mine that the kids go to every day. Like, it's not really like the time clock room on your way to work.
Yeah, he's like, oh, we'll just go out through the gift shop. Mm-hmm. Like, what? I don't know. It's. There's so much stuff, just like you're saying, where he just goes from one thing to the next thing to the next thing, and it's like there's no concern about how any of these things interrelate to one another to form any sort of cohesive whole.
Yeah. Plus, yeah, you've got all the lazy stuff borrowed from Raiders, like their guides who are leading them somewhere stops outside of a city and they move a bush and there's a big statue of something, but only this time it's more than just a statue that scares the guy away. The statue has like human fingers hanging around it and covered in blood. So, you know, same result. The guide leaves them and runs away, but like, it's just, I don't, it's a scene that was there. You had to get him off the elephants at some point or something.
Yeah. Oh man. That's what life is like. One day you just got to get off the elephant. Now it's also weird that you made that comparison to Raiders, because I think a big part of what I like about Raiders is Marion, and I think what a big part of what I hate about Temple of Doom is Willy. I find her completely unsympathetic at all. I do not root for her, quite the opposite. She's shrill, shouting constantly. She has this warble when she shouts for Indy, which is all I can think about, really. Whenever anybody mentions this movie, in the back of my mind, I just have Kate Capshaw going, "Indy!" And I'm just like, oh, please, no one talk about this movie, because that hurts my brain.
She only does it two or three times in that actual high-pitched voice. But yeah, it sticks with you, I guess.
It's really, it leaves an impression. But
yeah, of all the characters with questionable motivation, she's kind of the worst, right? Like, why is she even there? Like, she really ends up in the car in the opening by happenstance. Because he just kind of saves her, and she's got the antidote or whatever, which is a very stupid thing. And then, like, you know, she ends up on the plane because they're fleeing, and then they have to jump out of the plane or whatever because the plane's going to crash. And then they're in that little village there, and she's going to, I don't know, she says she's going to leave, but she doesn't leave. And then she goes with him to go to the place with the palace or whatever. But, like, why is she following him this whole time? Is it just because he's, like, the only white American guy that she can talk to, and she's stranded otherwise in the middle of India? Like, it doesn't make any sense.
No. Well, she's also depicted as being extremely shallow and attracted to wealth and power.
Mm-hmm.
So when she hears about the palace, like, she wants to go to the palace.
Didn't they say it was an abandoned palace or something?
Yeah, I don't remember. She's fixated on things that have to do with money and power. And like when, you know, they talk about the Shankara stones, and she's too scared from the ritual and she's hiding behind the rock face. And then he mentions the diamonds glow inside of the Shankara stones. Then she's like, diamonds? And then she peels out from around there to talk about the diamonds, because that's what her character cares about, not the people who die or
yeah,
anything.
And probing to see if the Maharaja has a wife yet, that kind of stuff.
Yeah, and, you know, she's also there to be sort of this incredibly vapid, self-centered person in regard to other cultures, but it's weird because that kind of backfires, because they don't... how should I put this? Other cultures are not treated delicately and with respect to this film, I would say. In particular, the meal scene really sticks out to me when they're in the palace and they are sitting around having the snake and etc. and the dessert is, of course, the chilled monkey brains, and it's just,
you got the beetles, you got the snake surprise where the guy's just shoveling glistening snake things into his mouth.
Yeah, and it's all just there to be gross stuff. Like, if you wanted to show her being some shallow American who can't deal with other cultures, you didn't necessarily need to make all of this other stuff just be gross, like Halloween, like trick-or-treat gross.
Eyeball soup.
Yeah, like, it just, I don't know. I don't understand. I don't understand the motivation behind that, because...
this mystical, magical land where cultures are different and stuff, and people eat snakes and giant beetles and belch and then have a good time and stuff.
Yeah, it's like... It's like you're trying to gross somebody out, like a little kid who's like, "Ooh, look how nasty this is." That's what I feel like a lot of the gross out moments in this film are. You know, like, "Oh, look at all those bugs. Oh, she went to go get her clothes and there was a bat." And it's just
that's a scene like straight out of Crocodile Dundee. But yeah, like this whole thing is like the Disneyification of like, "Look how gross that would be for little kids and stuff." But it's not ideal. I mean, I guess she's there to sort of be like somebody that he can do some exposition out loud to, but at the same time, like, he could have done that with Short Round or somebody else, because, you know, he's translating from the Indian guy who's speaking a different language, so he could have just translated that for anybody else who happened to be there. It didn't have to be this dumb blonde lady who was following him around.
Yeah.
Mm. Mm. So, let's see here. What else do we have in this movie that's of any interest, really?
We should talk about Short Round.
Can we talk about the title? The literal Temple of Doom?
I like the title, to be perfectly honest. It's
very
so
serious. Is that place really a temple, though?
No. I don't know what they filled out on their tax forms for that. But, yeah, the title, the way it is emblazoned behind her in the big dance number opening, is so gaudy and Flash Gordon-y and perfect. I love that. It's a complete contrast again to Raiders, where there was just this very simple, you know, serif, like Raiders of the Lost Ark, with the outline stuff, and they're just against like a simple jungle background, and this is like, There is a song and dance happening right there.
I was surprised to see the song and dance. I did not recall that this started with the song and dance.
I recall that because I think it might be one of the only things I kind of like a little.
No, why?
It's because it's so like grating and terrible and it knows that it's gaudy and over the top, that I'm fine with it. The only things that really bother me are when you cut away from the obviously small cocktail lounge stage to the big giant stage where they have the dancers. And it's like, why did that happen?
Yeah, it turns into like a dream sequence or something, because it turns into like a giant Hollywood dance number set. And then also, like, there's clips where the film is reversed, where they do this the leg kick and then the split and then it reverses. So it's like, is this just supposed to be like a fun movie that we're watching, or is this literally supposed to be happening in this club? Because it doesn't make sense as being in the club. But
yeah, it feels completely out of place. But It's and her and the lyrics to the song that she has, you know, Anything Goes. It's just like, ugh, geez, how over the top. And her outfit, just to talk about things that are just out there, as well as all of the backup dancers, etc. It is just a really over the top number. And so I kind of like that it went for it. I also like that we don't spend that much more time there, because it is over with rather quickly. I would not want to see that as like the main driving force behind the film, where they kept returning to this nightclub for more dance numbers.
No, it's you know, it's a, I don't know, it's like they do the same thing in The Rocketeer. Like, it's one of those scenes that, like, I would like to know where it started. I'm pretty sure we can't give this movie credit for being the first of these scenes that was then ruined by every subsequent scene, but just the whole, like, you know, comedy of errors thing with, like, kicking stuff around on the floor, and then everyone's trying to grab the thing right before somebody knocks it out of the way, and then it's covered in balloons, and they're digging around trying to find it, and then, like, I get what they were trying to do with, like, start off with an artifact scene or whatever, but he's not, like, bested by another smart person. Like, he's thwarted by his own stupidity, because he clearly drank something that the guy, like, snuck up there in the middle of this very tense negotiation. Like, why would you do that? Are you really just that dumb? Like, I saw the guy put the thing on the little Lazy Susan. I know that there was something suspicious there. Don't drink that. What are you doing?
Yeah, Lazy Susan is always suspicious. I mean, it was a good maneuver, though, for the camera to, like, go from track to one to the other, to follow that around. That's fun. But yeah, as far as drinking that. No, that was not a terribly good idea. And your main villain here is Lao Che, the I don't know, gangster, thug. What exactly? He seems to be a businessman though, because he has his own airline. Which
he's got what is it? Air cargo.
Yeah, Lao Che Air Cargo. Which you would think, if you were getting your escape plane organized for your Lao Che incident, you would not book it on that airline. Just a general rule of thumb. Like, if I'm going to escape from United Airlines CEO Oscar whatever his name is, I'm not going to do it on a United Airlines plane. It would be ridiculous.
Yeah, well, I mean, you know, he was distracted. Mm-hmm. So, you know, what are you going to do? Yeah, Lao Che, yeah. I knew this guy who looked familiar. He was in Bloodsport. Senzo Tanaka. I don't remember. Was he one of the trainer guys? Who was Tanaka here? Oh, yeah, he's the guy who trained Jean-Claude Van Damme.
Yeah.
Yeah. Got a good mustache in his IMDb photo. Unlike the guys at the dinner scene who had those like it may have been taken out of like the funny papers or whatever. The mustache is drawn on those people. It was ridiculous.
Yeah. I have to say, I am not a huge fan of the makeup or the set design in this film. When I say set design, I mean the caverns that are not really caverns. They don't measure up. Their fake rocks are not good enough at being fake rocks.
I thought the temple looked pretty ominous. Like, there were a lot of good large stone skull head type things.
Yeah, no, but I mean like the general rock quarry area and the rocks around like the altar stuff, and it didn't really look like rock.
Hmm. I have questions.
Looks like they were in a soundstage.
About the makeup of that facility. So, am I misremembering? Was the palace up on a very large hill? Because they go down underneath the palace into the temple, and then they go out the side, and then they're up on a cliff. So, is the palace a couple thousand feet high above the river with the alligators, or is that just like they're hoping we don't notice?
Yes. I would say, since we never saw a map, we don't actually know the altitude of that
right,
palace.
I'm just trying
relative
to remember, was there a shot where it was like Jeddah City or something, where it was like up on a big outcrop or something?
We never saw a shot that showed the palace's relationship to a cliff. We saw that it was up. But right. we didn't see like where cliffs were, you know, or norms. We didn't see where the norms were either.
It seems like
Norman Cliff, nothing.
I like Cheers. Although at this point, I think I like the idea of Cheers more than I like the actual show. I don't want to go back and rewatch it because I feel like it'll ruin it.
Oh yeah, no, I don't really want to revisit it myself. But I just wanted to make that joke.
I wish I had a Cheers bar.
There were the bar from Cheers. Do you know what popped into my head for a second?
A bar full of cheerleaders?
No, a candy bar. I was like, there was a candy bar called Cheers? And I was like, wait, no, he's talking about the bar from the show, you idiot. I'm very
tired. Cheers bar. Yeah, no, as far as I'm aware, there is not a candy bar named Cheers, but I would eat that too. It's probably beer and peanut
Ted Danson could check it on that. That'd be great.
God. Ted Danson.
What? He's so funny. He's a good sense of comic timing.
Does he?
I just watched the entire first season of The Good Place, and I quite enjoyed it.
Oh, that's right. He's in that one, isn't he?
Yeah, he was good in that. Now, do you know what would have been interesting? Putting Ted Danson in Temple of Doom, because then you could have a little bit more light comedy.
Where would he have fit in this movie?
I have no idea. I'm mostly just thinking that you should rewrite this thing from scratch, but it's neither here nor there at this point, I suppose.
I mean, yeah, the problem is that there is a lot of like really cool imagery in this. Like, I think you know, again, this is what the late 30s or something, like when they do the dinner scene, like Harrison Ford's little bow tie and his gray blazer is like a super awesome looking outfit from the 30s. And it's like, I think some of the art direction stuff in this movie is really cool and very Indiana Jones iconic stuff, but it's just like, it's wasted. It's immediately wasted as soon as anybody says or does anything.
Mm.
He's in his outfit with his hat, whipping stuff. It looks like he has a different hat though. Wasn't his hat in Raiders more, it looked more like a leather hat, and this one it was more of it's like a suede or a felt or something.
I didn't notice.
Mm.
It's just a brown hat with the band around it.
It was a fuzzy hat.
Yeah, and he reached underneath the thing that was closing to get his hat again.
Did he do the hat, or was it just the whip in Raiders?
It was the hat, I thought.
Well, he did the whip also in the opening scene.
Oh, okay.
I don't know. Maybe it was both.
Whatever. Anyway, it doesn't matter.
And then you've got you've got the other thing that they borrowed. You got the fight scene against the unusually large guard guy, as opposed to the unusually large Nazi guy.
See, why don't they have him square off against someone that seems like a real easy pushover? And then it turns out the surprise is he isn't a real easy pushover. Because right now, he always squares off against big guys. And it's like, well, I know how this is going to go. He's going to get beat up a bunch, and then it's going to super beat him up. And then, ta-da, he's got the upper hand. Yay. Yay,
yeah, they've got one of those scenes that we also come to know and love from movies like Die Hard 2, where they're fighting on conveyor belts and people getting squished.
Yeah, well, I mean, Die Hard 2 was after this, but...
Yeah, it's the same lazy, boring scene of just like Rube Goldberg battle through a goofy room.
Yeah, title. No, but there's also certain elements from this film that went on to kind of be seen elsewhere. The whole minecart chase thing that makes no sense. I don't know how the physics work in that scene.
They go fast, and then there's a jump and shoes. Like, again, that's like a Bugs Bunny Daffy Duck joke. Like with
Daffy Duke.
Yeah, I see. I'm tired too. Daffy Duck joke where he sticks his foot on the wheel to slow it down, and then his foot is smoking, and then water, and then there's a giant tidal wave coming, and they gotta run away and stuff.
Yeah, and you would see a lot of other places borrow these gags, like A View to a Kill, which was a James Bond movie that was a year after this. They also had a ridiculous mind scene and a shrill, uncharismatic love interest. But anyway,
wait,
I think you should watch that.
In View to a Kill?
Oh, I don't even remember. But you should definitely watch that sometime. I know that you haven't, but Christopher Walken.
Well, I've
on
seen
a blimp.
Parts of it. I'm trying to remember. Yeah. Who the lady was.
The really convoluted part is that somehow he's a Nazi eugenics experiment who raises horses, but he cheats by giving them certain horse steroids, but then that leads to the microchips, which he has in Silicon Valley, which leads to flooding Silicon Valley, is his master plan.
Maybe he was going to short the stock or something and make a bunch of money that way.
No. But anywho, anyways, any whatever. Not to get us off the track.
Yeah, you got to go down the left one, which is the one lit up by blue, not the one lit up by red, which is definitely very, very subtle. Mm-hmm. I mentioned it, I think, in the Slack there, but. The sound mix in this coming out of my TV was so bad, like I couldn't understand, like all of the stuff that was like supposed to be plot, like talking to the old Indian guy at the village, or some of the stuff at the dinner scene, like I just legitimately couldn't hear what any of these people were saying, and I was like trying, I was getting pieces, and none of it made any sense. I don't know if it would make more sense if I heard every word they said, but like, yeah, like I don't know, man, like this, none of it makes any sense. I didn't follow, yeah. Really. I didn't care. There was a village, and there was a dark evil thing that came from the palace that
stole the stone.
It stole the stone and it set fire to a field to distract them so they could come steal the kids and then enslave them. And then And now they're all sad because they don't have any kids or a stone that brings prosperity to them. And then one kid escapes and brings a piece of cloth, which is supposed to be a message or something. I don't know where he got the cloth or who told him to like bring a message to somebody to save the other ones. But then he, passes out and dies or something. And I guess that right there is supposed to be enough motivation for Indiana Jones to go like, hey, oh God, these people really need our help. I guess I should go help them instead of just like, well, we should get on our way now. Thanks for the food on the banana leaf.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. At least in this movie, somebody has heard of him. The guy who runs the palace with the glasses had heard of Indiana Jones.
That didn't make any sense to me, to be perfectly honest with you.
Well, he's an educated man who went to Cambridge or something, so of course he knows one of the world's most preeminent archaeologists or something.
I suppose. But if you were thinking of him as a preeminent archaeologist, then wouldn't you be like, oh, why are you here? How did that happen? Because you fell from a plane because you were escaping people because you robbed from this other thing? Okay.
Well, he's trying to pretend to be a nice host. Like, oh, I've heard of you. You should come inside and have some snake babies.
Mm-hmm.
Also, I'm pretty sure that's not what would happen if you cut a snake open.
No, that's definitely not.
But it's a surprise.
Hmm.
Or do you think they like put the little snakes through the big snake's mouth as a sort of like a way to like baste the little snakes?
Ugh. If you keep talking like that, I'm gonna have little snakes all over the place. Ugh.
Well, it's just like the big snake is just like it's like a vessel. You can fill it up with whatever you want.
Yeah, like a turducken of snakes. But it's just a snake inside of another snake, so it's just, you would just call it a snake.
It's a tersnaken.
No, there's no turkey. Oh, right. How are you going to put that big snake inside of a turkey?
Right, it's a snaken. Wait, I guess you don't have the, you don't even have the E-N, because that's the chicken.
Mm-hmm.
It's a snake.
Mm-hmm.
That doesn't sound very good.
No.
Snake Surprise is also a stupid name, but I guess it's a little better.
No.
No?
You would have been better? Like, not doing that scene.
Yeah, just having, like, Indian food there.
Yeah. I mean, it would have been something else to play off of if she had turned up her nose at actually having Indian food rather than having just random, Halloween stuff. Like, I think that would have been an interesting thing. And then you could still chide her and correct her on how she should be behaving in these matters. And the audience would be against her. They'd be in favor of these other people. But here, the audience is somehow supposed to be on her side. Like, oh, she shouldn't have to eat that eyeball soup. Ooh, gross. And it's like, no, I don't buy that.
Also, we have two of those scenes. We have the scene in the mm-hmm. village where he's like, eat the food. You're insulting them. Like, this is, they're giving you more food than they eat. And she's like, I don't know what this is. I don't want to eat it. And then you get the same scene later where he's just not there to chide her because he's more invested in bringing up fairy tales and insulting the Maharaja's right-hand man dude, whatever his name was.
The Prime Minister.
The Prime Minister, yeah.
Mm-hmm. Chatterlal.
Chatterlal.
Yeah.
Is that his name?
Or Chitar.
Hmm.
Was it Chitar? Anyway, it doesn't matter. He's prime minister guy in the film to the Maharaja, and he. I don't know. I don't understand. He's kind of there, but not.
He shows up later at the temple scene where Indy's doing the thing, lowering her into the thing. Oh! While we're talking about the Maharaja, what's up with where did the voodoo doll come from? Why is there a voodoo doll?
There's no sensitivity played for the props, like the shrunken head thing and stuff.
Where was there a shrunken head?
Or on top of the headdress of the bad guy, Mola Ram.
Oh, mm-hmm. Right.
But, like, again, it didn't that doesn't, like, there's just a bunch of like random things where people are like, oh, this is exotic and evil, I guess let's put it in here. And it's like, okay, like, I don't think you need to like doodle in the lines, I guess, but whatever. So you got some of that.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Voodoo doll. And I guess the advantage of wearing a large ornate headdress is that you can store like pins and stuff in there, so you can stab people whenever you need to.
That's a primary concern that I have.
It's really missing from today's headwear. I mean, I wear a baseball hat from time to time, and it doesn't really have an accommodation for a small knife or pin.
Well, you should do that. You should modify the hat that you have that has the little compact flash card pocket.
I don't really wear that one so much anymore, but yeah, I could.
Yeah, well, that's a perfect place to hide all your pins.
As long as they're like 1.25 inches wide by 1 inch tall.
Okay, well, how big of a pin do you need?
I don't big enough to stab the voodoo doll that I have hidden in my jacket.
Just get a very tiny voodoo doll. Like then you can have very tiny pins. And it's really about like how big does a voodoo doll need to be in order to actually work?
Well, about, you know, 8-12 inches, something like that. But, you know, the other thing I want to know is, do you think he has like a mix and match, like Lego set of voodoo doll pieces? Or did he like, after the weird dinner, did he go back and like hand stitch the miniature leather jacket to put on the voodoo doll?
I don't know. Maybe he had somebody do that for him. He's like, make me a tiny leather jacket. And they're like, what? And they're like, just do it. I need it for my doll. And it's like, okay, whatever you say.
This was back before Mattel. So you would really have to get one of your servant peoples to do it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Mm. So anyway.
Mm-hmm. That was a part of the movie that there was that.
Mm-hmm.
And then the giant bucket of water they knock over, which is literally just like a comically large sized bucket, is apparently enough to flood floor to ceiling through a mine, which isn't really like a downhill run, so it's not really like the water would do that, especially because it wouldn't fill floor to ceiling, it would just kind of like level out.
Yeah.
And be like 1 inch high. For a really long time.
You should definitely see a view to a kill. But anyway, there's also the element of the British Army captain who's...
It's just there.
Yeah, but then brings in the rifleman to assist in fighting the bad guys at the end. And it's like, yay, colonial British imperialism. Hooray.
He was there, and he was on Indiana Jones' side. He wasn't very bright, but he was listening like, oh, Indiana Jones is right. Yeah, there's interesting folklore here. And then, like, the kids escape, which I presume is what tipped him off to, like, the incident and to show up with his guys with guns. And then when they leave, Indiana Jones gets to the village, and then the kids are behind him. Like, the kids were freed from this long, treacherous slavery thing that they were involved in. And they made sure to like grab the kids up in a circle and go, guys, we're gonna do a really dramatic reveal. Don't go home yet. Let's all go home together, and then it'll look real cool because people think I saved you and stuff. So, well,
maybe they were just tired and they were walking. I mean, they have tiny little legs. They're kids, Dan.
Oh, so you think he got there faster because he has longer legs?
Yeah,
but they escaped like 3 scenes before he was done fighting on the thing.
Well, I mean, have you seen Harrison Ford? He's at least 3 scenes high.
I don't know what that means.
Neither do I.
Is that a Don Rickles joke? I hear his jokes often didn't make sense.
No, that was just something I felt like saying. Now
it's like three blind mice, but 3 scenes high.
Yeah. Well, a Smurf is 3 apples.
Wait, what?
A Smurf is 3 apples high. Did you know that? I know that. Do you know why?
Is that the in-house measuring system they used?
No, apparently that's like how it's written up. They're supposed to be 3 apples high or some stuff like that. But have you ever had three apples that are exactly the same height, because they can vary widely. I mean, what if you got a Red Delicious and you got a Gala and then you got a Honeycrisp? You try to stack all of those?
I've never had an apple that was symmetrical enough that the top would have provided an area to stack another apple.
Yeah, usually when you go to the grocery store, you get those apples that have like one really big side and one slightly smaller side, and so it's always kind of a pain in the butt when you try to chop them up.
Yeah, it's like a 70-degree angle.
Yeah.
See, but when you say three apples high, mm-hmm. being from production, I would assume that means it's three apple boxes high, which I believe is 3 feet, so that's not...
No, that would be horrifying.
three foot tall Smurf.
Yeah, that would be a real terror. That's not a thing.
Did you go see the new Smurfs?
Of course I didn't. I very gleefully refreshed the page of Box Office Mojo to see that it made less than any prior Smurfs movie. But that's neither here nor there.
Your record still holds. Oh man, look at that. I actually got the measurements right. The A side of the apple box is 12 inches.
Okay.
Oh, no, wait, no, that's 8 inches there. They're typically used 8. 8, 12, 20, so.
It's fascinating.
Yeah, you can turn them on the different sides to get different heights.
It's almost like it's a box.
Mm-hmm. So 24 inches would be your standard 3 apple Smurf.
Okay.
Mm-hmm.
But it's not.
I think terrifying. I think the Smurfs are 24 inches tall. They just maybe they live in a world that where stuff is bigger.
No, they don't, because they went to the real world in at least two movies.
Oh, was there a live action crossover?
Yes, two of them.
Wait, is that the ones with
Neil Patrick Harris?
Yeah, I forgot that was a Smurfs movie.
And Hank Azaria is Gargamel. It's not funny. I'll tell you that right now.
Hank Azaria can do anything. He's got a lot of voices in him.
Did he
wear that like black dress thing?
Yeah.
That's one of those outfits that only works in a cartoon. If you put that on a purse, it probably looks absurd.
And a really bad rubber nose. Anyway, let's not talk about movies that hurt my feelings. Let's move on to this movie.
why does it hurt your feelings?
Because I worked on two of them, and I don't have it.
Is the movie's existence an affront to you?
No, I just don't. I don't have love deep within my being for the Smurfs movies. Is all I'm saying.
But that's totally different now for you and me and all of us, that we all have deep love for the things we work on, right?
I wonder if everyone's going to have a podcast player that will take out that long pause. But
not everybody.
No, not everybody. But anyway, so Temple of Doom. I'm sure there's some people who regret working on that, but... You don't know who they are.
I feel like this is one of those movies where when you were making it, it felt probably like it was going to be a good thing. Because all of the disparate pieces are similar enough to Raiders that you might not really notice what's going on. Although I feel like there is, I don't know, what, like a quarter of the actual conversation in this movie as was in Raiders. Like they actually talked about stuff and they talked about it in a smart way in Raiders. In this one... What do you got? You got a little bit of that exposition scene with the old Indian guy in the village. You've got that awkward conversation at dinner where Indiana Jones is kind of insulting the guy, which is also shot a little bit weird, but it's supposed to be, I don't know, kind of, you know, it kind of reminded me of the Belloc scene when he got drunk with Marion after Marion was supposed to be dead or whatever. But it's just like those are the only scenes really where stuff happens, I think, aside from the opening.
Sure. Sounds about right.
Yeah.
Yeah.
You got some hilarious will they won't they tension with the you'll be back in my room in 5 minutes thing. And then there's a guy standing in the back, very obviously doesn't look like the painted wall, and then sneaks up and tries to strangle him, but ends up getting hung by a ceiling fan.
Mm-hmm.
Apparently Indian palaces in the 1930s had ceiling fans.
I suppose so. But you got to be careful how you're installing those so you don't accidentally trip the secret doors.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I don't know if it's just because we're both very tired or if there's literally nothing to talk about in this movie.
No, I mean, I can only think of negative things to say, which are kind of mostly just like this film is boring. You know, so it's not a big deal, mm-hmm. Really. I feel like if this had been the last Indiana Jones film, that it would have been a real, it would have left a real sour taste in my mouth in regards to the franchise, because it would have been two movies, one good one and one really bad one. And I'm fortunate in that I also really like The Last Crusade, which was the film after this film. And I am looking forward more towards watching that one than watching this one. I was very reluctant to watch this film. In fact, I believe I had said something like, oh, we could just watch Raiders and then move on to some other stuff if we're crunched on time. Because now we have a sour taste in our mouths yet to come, because we'll have Crystal Skull after that. And I find that one to be incredibly unpalatable as well. But I haven't seen it since it was in theaters, since I saw it the one and only time that I've ever seen it. So maybe I'll remember, maybe I'll feel differently about those ants now, or the monkeys, or literally anything, or Shia LaBeouf. Remember Shia LaBeouf?
I do remember him, and I have seen it more recently than you have, and I will alert you to keep your expectations as low as possible, because it's not good. None of those things are good. It's bad. But I don't know, I feel like I don't feel like Temple of Doom really like leaves me with a bad taste in my mouth, aside from Kate Capshaw being insufferable, because, you know, you've got, if anything, all it does is just remind you of this, you know, that there, this character exists, and he travels to strange places and does mystical borderline type things that have something to do tangentially related to history and artifacts and stuff. And it's the 30s and stuff, but I don't know, you could cut Temple of Doom down into probably a 20-minute like prologue for Last Crusade, and then it would be fine. Like, you know, having seen a bunch of this on TV growing up, I feel like the world would be worse off if this movie was just like destroyed or didn't exist, because, you know, it's got stuff in it, imagery, images.
It has stuff.
I mean, it's basically a movie poster, which is fine for Indiana Jones, but
by Drew Struzan.
Mm-hmm. Sure. Mm-hmm. Is he the guy who does the Star Wars ones too?
Yeah. The colorful illustration stuff. He's a good guy. Does a lot of good posters. But you know, I agree with you. Maybe you could edit this down to be much more succinct, little interlude between.
It could be a webisode, because like production for the next real movie got delayed, so they put out a little webisode to tide the audience over.
Yeah, 118 minutes.
This movie did not need to be that.
No, there's so much of this where it's just like, why do you need this scene? What does it do? Nothing. Okay, bye. See you later.
Very few of these scenes do anything, because again, the characters don't have any goals or motivations other than like, I guess maybe we'll take a look into seeing if we can figure out what happened to this guy, this village's kids, and then the rest of their goals are don't die.
Yeah.
But like, I was bummed out, like, after that large convoluted opening, which, you know, where he gets swindled out of his stuff, like, I would have expected a little bit more from this guy, like, find a way to, like, you know, lose him around the block and then sneak back into the bar after Lao She left, and then go find your diamond or whatever. Like, why is he giving up on that so easy? And then he's, like, getting on the plane all like, haha, I got the best of you because I escaped, and then closes the door and is like, no, he got the best of you. But it's like, you totally like gave up on the whole reason you were there in the first place.
Hmm.
Go get your diamond, man.
Diamonds are forever.
I mean, I guess. You could smash them. Just a rock, really.
Yeah.
It's a hard rock, but it's just a rock.
Well, it's not a hard rock.
Okay.
Because it's... yeah.
It doesn't have any Arnold Schwarzenegger memorabilia inside of it.
Isn't that Planet Hollywood?
Oh, right.
Wait, yeah.
I think they both have memorabilia.
Yeah, but...
Rock and roll memorabilia would be in the rock and roll. God, I am tired, aren't I?
Yeah. It's okay.
It doesn't have any fake Jimi Hendrix bandanas in it. How about that?
Yeah, it doesn't have any terrible Bob Dylan stuff inside of it.
I don't think probably Bob Dylan
contributed.
I don't think he's particularly into like donating a guitar or like a funny looking hat to the Hard Rock Cafe.
No, probably not. I just wanted to say something about Bob Dylan. But
Did you know he released a 3-disc record recently?
Oh, good. Does everything just sound like mumbling again, like always?
Couldn't tell you. I know you could buy it on vinyl, and there's 3 of them in a thing.
Oh, fantastic news.
Mm-hmm.
I can think of several reasons why I won't be doing any of the things that would allow me to hear that. But, yep, there you have it.
You sold your record player.
Of course, that's my reason. I sold my record player so I could buy you a gold comb, and then you sold your locks of hair so that you could buy me a record of the Bob Dylan collection. It's a real O. Henry of a story.
I'm glad that you tied that together so well.
Yeah.
Oh, I sold my hair to buy you a record. And you sold your record player to buy me a gold comb.
Yeah, that's... you're not familiar with the Gift of the Magi? And
no, I am. Okay. It's just the... I was just making sure I got the transfer in there correct. The record.
It's a real hair to record story.
I'm writing it in the thing. Hang on. Mm-hmm. Joel sold his record player for a gold comb. And Dan sold his hair for a record. That's good. Right there.
Yeah. Talk about hair metal.
That's not...
No, that's not Bob Dylan. Bob Dylan does hair metal.
It's also not where the term hair metal comes from, as far as I'm aware.
Uh-huh.
I don't think to be classified as hair metal, you have to sell your hair for a record.
Mm-hmm. For the record, I think you're right.
But that would be interesting. That would be an easy way to switch genres anytime you felt like it. You just shave your hair.
Yeah. I call it dropping the needle.
That's a different thing.
Yeah. So I think we're done. You wanna pack up early?
I feel bad. I feel like we're shorting people.
I don't, because... This movie's not good. Anyone who wants to hear lots of fun stuff, go back to the previous episode.
Yeah, we had such a good time last week and good conversation, mm-hmm. talking about the art of cinema and, you know, all of the great things.
Yeah, and with somebody who probably cared about it more than we did.
there was also some silly dramatic underlighting, unmotivated underlighting in this movie for the bad guy in the opening scene there.
Yeah, well, I mean, you also have the lava pit, which gives you red light. Mm-hmm. That's what lava does. It's red.
Yeah, it's swirly,
mm-hmm.
and liquidy.
Mm-hmm.
Twister is going to be playing at our local Alamo Draft House in about a week and a half. I think I might go see that.
Fantastic. Mm-hmm. Is it an original print, or are they just...
Oh, I doubt it.
And because you know, I don't know if the film will have aged very well if it were, but yeah, you can You can go check that out. Let me know how you feel about the flying cows.
Mm-hmm. Same cow, I think, but...
I thought there were two of them.
It's the same cow, it just comes by twice.
Oh.
Remember, that's what they say. There's another cow, and I think that was the same one.
Well, that's because it's one if by land and two if by waterspout.
See, if you were a real Twister fan like Seth, you would know how many cows there were.
I will just come right out and say it. Definitely not a real Twister fan.
I like Twister. It's good. It's got one of Philip Seymour Hoffman's more absurd roles.
You know, now that you mentioned that, I kind of want to see a list. Like
Philip Seymour Hoffman movies?
Yeah, how exactly do you rank more ridiculous roles? Like from least to most ridiculous for him.
Well, he did do a lot of different things, didn't he?
Yes, exactly. So I don't know how you would put that on some sort of a spectrum of ridiculousness. It would be ridiculous. But yeah.
I'm looking through his stuff. I like the ones where he plays kind of the straight man, because those are good. I mean, like Punch Drunk Love, or you got like Big Lebowski and stuff like that. He's definitely more of a straight man. But Mission Impossible
or
3.
Polly, whatever that one was.
Along Came Polly. That was nuts. that's up there with ridiculous roles, but I don't know that it quite beats Twister.
Oh, man.
So, he plays a character named Sandy Lyle. Sandy Lyle Seth Gray.
Interesting.
Yeah. He's the child actor that can't get away from his role. That's the movie that that popularized a portmanteau that describes ruining your shorts.
Oh.
Mm-hmm.
Great.
I didn't want to say it on the show.
No, I don't want you to either. That's why I just said great.
He was good in Mission Impossible 3 as the bad guy.
Okay. Spoiler alert.
That's not a spoiler. Did you ever see Charlie Wilson's War, by the way?
Nope.
He's good in that one also.
Okay.
Do you ever see movies? You familiar with the concept of movies?
Sometimes I watch them and sometimes I don't. I haven't seen every movie.
You're not a big fan of Philip Seymour Hoffman?
I mean, he's fine. I have no opposition towards him.
Okay. We don't speak ill of the dead, Joe.
I was being completely indifferent.
I know. We don't speak indifferent of the dead.
I beg to differ.
That's true.
I beg to indifer.
Temple of Doom, 1984. That was a bad year.
Yeah. My sister was born that year.
Me too.
You have a sister?
No.
Yeah, I was about to say.
I was the sister that was born in 1984.
Oh. Anyway. Okay.
No. So I guess we'll button this up. We'll save our energy for Last Crusade.
Yes. Yes. Yeah. And work on our Sean Connery impersonations.
I can do the line from The Rock.
Welcome to The Rock. Is that the one you're gonna do?
No. Losers always whine about their best.
So we'll go ahead.
No, I'm not.
Treat us. No. Are you saving it for next week for a special occasion?
I'm saving it for when we do The Rock, or okay. Also when I'm in the mood to say stupid, inappropriate Michael Bay dialogue.
Okay. Well, everyone, start your write-in campaign for The Rock. I look forward to Dan getting all of that correspondence.
Chris, send it by snail mail.
Yes.
It's the only way I'll accept it.
Yes. Please don't staple it to the snails. They don't like that.
What if they do?
I don't think they do, but I suppose we could host a forum, ask a couple questions.
Yeah, you don't tell the snails what they are and are not into.
Mm-hmm. I'm Oh, I was going to do a pun. I was going to say mollusk. I mollusk you a question, but I can't. It doesn't work because I was going to say I must ask you a question, but you can't substitute must ask for mollusk. No, you can't. You can't do it. I just tried.
Mollusk you a question.
See?
No, you're missing a syllable in there is what it is.
Yeah.
Hey. Well, that's a nice failure to end on.
Yes.
To tie it in with this movie.
Yes. It is shell of a good time.
Shell like the top of a monkey skull.
No, that's not what a shell is. I was talking about the snail again.